Thank you, Madam Bailiff. Counsel, this is the case of State ex rel Peterson versus Shively. And we will not do introductions of the court, but you should be aware, as I think you can see, that Justice Papik is recused from this matter. Judge Arterburn from the Court of Appeals will be sitting with the court today. Mr. Campbell, you are here with us. And Mr. Lopez, you are here with us. Do either counsel have any questions before we begin? Very good. Mr. Campbell, then you may approach and you may proceed. And we have, is it 15 minutes per side?
Yes, Your Honor.
Very good.
Good morning, Mr. Chief Justice, and may it please the court. James Campbell on behalf of the Attorney General, and I'd like to reserve 4 minutes for rebuttal. This case presents a straightforward question of constitutional interpretation. Article 9, Section 4 of the state constitution says that the legislature shall provide by law for the election of such county and township officers as may be necessary. But when the legislature—
What does that as may be necessary mean?
Well, it's our argument, as we've explained in the reply, that it modifies the word officer because it's most closely placed to the officer. And so what that communicates is that the legislature is free to create offices. It can define the office's duties and it can lay out the qualifications for the offices. But what it can't do is what the appellees are arguing, which is they can't create an office that has all the indicia of a county office and yet declare that it is not, in order to avoid the requirement that the position must be elected. The district court, in a nutshell, gave deference to historical practices, but it elevated history over the plain constitutional text. That is a significant problem because unlawful acts, no matter how long standing they are, cannot rewrite the Constitution. And the appellees, for their part, they call for an extreme deference to the legislature. According to them, the legislature can declare that a position bearing all the indicia of a county office is not the kind of county office that must be elected. But giving the legislature that kind of power would render Article 9, Section 4 meaningless and effectively write it out of the Constitution.
Mr. Campbell, I have a couple of questions with respect to the language. And the first one is, you will be aware that in 1968, there was language added to Article 9, Section 4. I take it you are not contending that that language that was added in 1968 is in any way significant to the question that's before us today.
I do not. I think it actually helps us in that it refutes a number of the arguments that the NACO amicus brief makes, but for purposes of our argument, it is not relevant.
Okay, so then the language that essentially would stop with the word necessary existed, it entered the Constitution in the 1875 Constitution and was relocated but unchanged in the 1920 Constitution. What is your understanding of the historical understanding of the meaning of those words at the time they were adopted by the people that adopted?
I think the best indicator of that are dictionaries at the time, as well as U.S. Supreme Court precedent that existed at that very time that had already defined terms like officer. So when you look at cases like Hartwell, which is a U.S. Supreme Court decision that came out right around that 1875 date, the Supreme Court laid out the very same definition of officer that this court later repeated in the Tusa case.
Is it significant what the legislature had prior to 1875? For example, in the compiled statutes of 1873, the legislature had specified what officers of counties would be elected and specified, in fact, a number and said one county clerk. How does that language inform our understanding?
Well, I think to the extent the court considers it, it bolsters the reading that we offer. And here's why. Because by including the as may be necessary language and by connecting it to the term officer, the people were making it clear and ratifying the language that the legislature was in fact free to create additional offices, county offices. But what it couldn't do is provide for them to be put in office by any way other than election. Because to read this constitutional provision any other way would be effectively to read the word shall, which comes early in the provision, right out of the Constitution. And that would be a significant problem.
Is your argument that the deputy election clerk should be elected also?
That is our argument, yes. And there's a couple reasons why. This chief deputy is different from, as best we can tell, every other deputy that exists under in the counties. And here, there's a significant reason for that. First and foremost, the legislature calls their position an office. Secondly, the legislature gave them a set term of office and also gave them tenure against removal, some form of protection against removal. That doesn't exist for any other chief deputy or deputy, as far as we can tell, that exists at the county level. And so for that reason, these chief deputies are different from other deputies, and they are county officers, just like the election commissioner is. And there's one other reason to emphasize.
Pretty close to an absurd interpretation.
I don't think so, Your Honor. And one of the other important facts, I think, to keep in mind in the analysis is that we have to consider it in context of this case, right? And so in the context of this case, we're arguing that the appointment of these election commissioners should be declared void. Well, that raises the next question of whether these chief deputies can step into that position. And in order to answer that question, we look to the statutes and see that if they are able to step into that position, they assume all the duties and all the powers of the election commissioners. And so for that reason, under the circumstances of this case, the chief deputies are in fact just a stand-in for the election commissioners. And so we do think that they would be officers as well. Having said that, I'll candidly acknowledge it's a closer question. And I think the more important question is whether the election commissioners are county officers. And if they are, as we argue they are, then what's going on right now is a violation of the plain constitutional text.
I beg your pardon. In connection with that last analysis, I can't tell what the textual explanation is for your analysis. Might the deputy just be an officer in waiting and not an officer?
Well, again, under the circumstances of this case, they would assume all the duties of the election commissioner. And so we think for purposes of the analysis here that they are in fact an officer. And when you add in the fact that they are indeed protected against arbitrary removal, which other deputies aren't, and they are given a set term of office, which other deputies aren't, I think that that separates them enough to put them into the officer camp. But again, I wouldn't fight too much on this point, because I do think it's a far closer question. I think when you go to the election commissioners, it's not a close question. Whatever indicia the court wants to look at, if you look at the TUSA factors, they all support us. If you look at the factors that other courts have laid out for distinguishing state officials from county officials, they all favor us too. Those courts have recognized that if a position is selected for a county, if its authority is limited to the county border, if the person must be residing in the county, and if the duties of the office pertain more specifically to the voters of the county, that all of those factors indicate we're dealing with a county, not a state officer. And all of those factors are satisfied here. In addition to those factors, when we look at the nature of this position, we see that the county employs the election commissioner. The county sets their salary, the county pays their salary, the county pays their expenses, the county pays for all their supplies, and the county has to provide them with office space.
What do you make of the historical curiosity, describe it that way, that you have this election commissioner appointment system that it's established in 1913, and in 1920 at the Constitutional Convention, the language of Article 9, Section 4 remains absolutely unchanged. I'm not making a long historical argument that just because it existed that way, it should persist. But I am asking, how does that existence in 1913 inform the understanding of the constitutional convention participants in 1920.
Your Honor, I don't think it does, because there's no, as best we can tell, there's no evidence that the folks who were working on the 1920 Constitution, that they considered this issue one way or the other. And so for that reason, I don't think it informs the Constitution on a constitutional analysis. I think this is the way the court should look at it, that occasionally a contemporaneous practice can inform constitutional interpretation. But this language was put in place in 1875, and the appointment of an election commissioner did not come into play until nearly 40 years later. And so for that reason, that practice doesn't really inform the original understanding, because it grew up at a later point in time.
I'm curious about the unintended consequences of your argument. I'm real clear on this, but I think maybe the district court made some reference to jail matrons, for example. What other officers out there would we suddenly discover have to be elected if we agreed with you?
First point is, I don't think that the matron of the county jail would need to be elected. We disagree with the district court on that point. If you engage in an analysis of all the TUSA factors, you'll find that a number of them are missing with the matron, for example. First and foremost, that position does not have a term of office, nor does it have tenure against removal. In addition, I would point the court to the Germain decision.
The legislature can change all of those things, can't they?
The legislature could, and to the extent it wants to make a position look more and more like an office, then that position must be elected. That is indeed true. But I think a number of the allegations that are currently made, that if we win this case, you would sweep in all of these officials, I just don't think that those are well settled, because they never address these factors. They never go through the analysis and explain how this particular official actually qualifies as an officer. But one important point is that there's a greater harm here. There's a greater potential harm at stake in this case than the possibility that a few more people might have to be listed on a local ballot. The greater harm here is that if these obvious county officers can be appointed, then nothing would stop the legislature from going in and providing for the appointment of other county officers. That's the greater harm. And unless there are further questions, I'd like
to respond. I'll make it very quick. Given the statutory scheme, why aren't these particular officers actually state officers rather than county officers?
I think there's a number of reasons. I'll try to be brief. The most straightforward way to look at this is that the other side argues two things, that these officers argue are exercise state power and that they're subject to state control. I think neither of those carry the other side where they want to go. In terms of exercising state power, that's what all county officers do. They're purely agents of the state, and they only exercise the power given from the legislature. In fact, this court has recognized that county officials regularly perform functions connected to the administration of state government. So I don't think that argument gets them very far. And if you look at other admitted county officers, like county clerks, county assessors, county attorneys, their duties all come from state law. Well, at least a significant number of them come from state law too. And the most interesting part I find of the other side's argument is that they fail to reckon with the fact that county clerks are almost identically situated in terms of election duties to the election commissioners. They're subject to the same oversight of the Secretary of State. They perform the same election-related functions, yet we all admit that they are county officers.
Well, aren't they doing a lot more? Aren't there other duties for a county clerk than there are for election commissioner?
There are, but I don't think that should change the analysis, because they are performing a substantial number of duties that are election related. So unless the court is prepared to create an analysis where an official is a county officer for some purposes and a state officer for another purpose, which the U.S. Supreme Court at least said that that would be a bad idea in the Lucia case, then I don't think it should affect the analysis. I think the court should look and say, if you're performing duties and you're performing them and they have a particular effect on the people in your locality, that you are in fact a county officer.
Still county assessors that are not locally elected, or is that gone?
I'm sorry, I.
And there's still county assessors that are not locally elected.
I believe, I'm not familiar one way or the other. But I will say that in terms of the county assessor, if you look at the statute that we've cited, which is section 77 dash, I think it's 1330, we cited it in our opening brief, the amount of control that the state property tax administrator and the state tax commission has over county assessors, in my opinion, it might exceed the amount of control that the secretary of state exercises. And so I think that's further proof that the other side's control argument doesn't get them where they want to go. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Mr. Lopez, good morning to you.
Good morning. Mr. Chief Justice, may it please the court.
Apologies.
The AG invites the court to invalidate a century-old, bipartisan-supported, functioning election commissioner appointment system that has been reaffirmed by the legislature at every opportunity it has been presented to repeal it, including most notably just in the last few legislative sessions. The AG's theory.
Does that matter?
It doesn't.
10 years old. It's been put in for a good purpose. Those things matter in a constitutional determination.
It does not matter from the standpoint of looking at the AG's argument that we are trying to defend the election commissioner appointment system on its policy merits alone. There's a couple points, though, that are exceptions to that. One, the reason we describe the legislature's having reaffirmed it so many times over the last century is because it feeds into the principle that it remains a relevant part of the overall scheme that the legislature is trying to achieve in creating independent election commissioner offices that are not subject to appointment. That is not an attempt to escape election. That is rather an attempt to create a county level governmental unit that will independently administer elections without itself being subject to election. It also responds to some of the policy counter arguments that the AG and the Civic Nebraska brief have offered, which is that somehow to the extent that the policy merits of the election commissioner system ever mattered, that they only mattered in the context of the original justification, which was the Tom Dennison crime machine in Omaha. Well, that is easily dispensed with, given that, as best I know, the Dennison machine doesn't exist anymore. And yet, as recently as just the last several years, the legislature has seen fit to keep this system. So I think, you know, I just want to be clear on that. We are not writing in here and justifying their constitutionality just based on the fact that it's a good idea. Its characteristics from a policy standpoint feed into how the court should view the scheme that the legislature is trying to, or the regime that the legislature is trying to achieve, but it's not a freestanding justification for its constitutionality.
Are these election commissioners public officers?
The district court concluded no. Admittedly, that is in tension. That is in some tension.
Have
with
we
what
said that they are?
You said so in Lautenbach. You said so in McHugh. And that is why we're not making a full frontal argument that they are not county officers. Our argument.
Great context, those cases, of what they're, why they were discussed, public officers or not, how they could be sued or where they could be sued and things like that.
They absolutely were. They're not dispositive for, well, a couple different things. One, Justice Funk, your implication is absolutely correct. That in neither McHugh or in the Lautenbach decision was the Article 9, Section 4 question squarely before the court. I think more importantly, though, not only was Article 9, Section 4 not before the court, in general, the county officer question is not coextensive with the public officer question. And this dovetails with a question Justice Castle asked in colloquy with my friend a moment ago, which is why couldn't they be some sort of state officer? We certainly know from the Eason decision that there are, we'll call them much lower and less grand than constitutional officers like the governor, the secretary of state, the attorney general and the like, that can qualify as a state officer. So I think that is a perfectly reasonable interpretation of where election commissioners fit in the grand scheme of interlocking state and county government.
So in the Essen case, we said that a professor was a public officer, is that correct?
Yes.
Are there other examples of public officers beyond that?
Well, In the Conway versus the Spire versus Conway case, it would be another example where someone working in a state in that context, it's another educational institution. It was the state college system, but I think the same analysis would apply. I think here, if you look to the Dwyer case, for example, where you spoke in broad terms, and this builds on Dinsmore, I think, and I'm getting ahead of some of my arguments here, but I think it fits. This builds on Dinsmore in the sense that the court has repeatedly acknowledged that the legislature has plenary authority to determine that some special governmental unit will be created to solve a particular need and to determine the characteristics of that office. You said that in Dinsmore. I think Dinsmore applies here. Their efforts to distinguish it, I think are without merit. You effectively expanded upon that with the Dwyer decision, where a commission had been authorized by the legislature to be created that was partially exercising county power. And nevertheless, in the same decision, you concluded that the commissioners were not county officers for purposes of Article 9, Section 4, triggering the election requirement.
So what is your textual argument? As may be necessary, the language in the Constitution.
So if the court has to get there, and let me premise my answer, Mr. Chief Justice, with the threshold response that I don't think you need to get to that question, which is a thornier question than the threshold question. I think you can decide this question on the overall case on question one, which is that election commissioners are not county officers for purposes of Article 9, Section 4, which leaves for another day the question of how much play is in the joints of as may be necessary. My friend presented in the reply brief for the first time an argument that the rule of the last antecedent would require that as may be necessary modifies only the township and county officers phrase within that term. I think if you look to some of the successive Supreme Court, U.S. Supreme Court decisions regarding the rule of last antecedent, several of which are from just the last couple years, one of them is Lockhart from 2016, there's a lot of discussion about how if it makes sense to read the phrase as applying to the entire, to read the modifier as applying to the entire phrase, then it can apply to the entire phrase. That's consistent with what we've argued all along, which is that as may be necessary strongly hints that the legislature has more authority and plenary authority, which is consistent with what you said in Dwyer, to determine that some entities, some officers who are at the county level can nevertheless be subject to appointment. Let me make an even broader practical point in service of.
May I beg your pardon. I'm sorry to interrupt, but maybe I'm just retracing something you're implying. Perhaps on the breadth of authority, is that a function of separation of powers, or is that irrelevant to the breadth of authority?
Justice Miller-Lerman, I don't think it's irrelevant. I think from the standpoint of separation of powers, you've discussed it already in the context of the and it'd be more of a vertical division of governmental power issue than a separation of powers, than a horizontal issue at the state level. But I think I would still fall back on my reference to what you've already said in both the Dinsmore decision and then expanding upon it in Dwyer in speaking very broadly about the plenary authority the court, that the legislature has to just determine the nature and characteristics of officers at the county level.
If we were to adopt your view, could the legislature say all sheriffs, all county sheriffs are no longer, there aren't going to be county sheriffs. They're just going to be a state level law enforcement agency.
Well, it could absolutely do that. There's no question that it can abolish an office. The more specific question is that I think Justice Castle you're getting at is, will this yield this parade of horribles that all of a sudden the legislature will begin willy-nilly taking the officers that we traditionally think of as being officers at the county level and depriving the people of their opportunity to elect them. And this actually goes to the next point I was going to make in response to the Chief Justice. The legislature's already done that. They've already construed over the years that some of the offices that we that are undisputed county offices, I don't think anyone involved in this case would dispute our county offices, can be subject to appointment. We know that with the appointed county attorney position. We know that also with county surveyors and engineers. If you look to the complex statutory scheme that is set forth under 23-1901.1.
Aren't all of those examples, however, folks that just aren't available in particular counties?
That's the argument they've made with regard to the county attorney position, Justice Castle, and perhaps that carries the day. They've cited the Van Horn decision for the point that provisional appointments might be able to assist there. It's definitely not true with county surveyors and engineers. The county surveyor and engineer appointment provisions do not hinge on an election failing and then needing to provide for the office. So at least with regard to that, to that office, we already have it. We already have appointed undisputed county officers. That's also true with veteran service officers, which are not necessarily the ones that roll off the tongue when we think about what are county officers, but nevertheless.
Also weed commissioners or some.
So I was going to put a limiting principle on my argument, Mr. Chief Justice. Those three that I've just mentioned are the ones that I am sure are county officers, and we already have appointment provisions in the law for them, which means that this historical argument that somehow, or this argument that somehow the legislature is going to go off the rails without this constitutional guardrail that it has construed itself not to be bound by, comes without any historical support. The NACO brief ably discusses a variety of other offices that may meet the characteristics of county of office under TUSA and are currently appointed. My argument is you don't even need to get there. We certainly haven't devoted any analysis to those particular, to that particular batch of offices. We think you can get there. You can adopt the argument just based on viewing the county surveyor, county attorney, veteran service officer alone. Those are all officers that we see in Chapter 23. Let me turn for a moment to this four-factor test and return to the question one in the case, which is how do we determine what are county officers? The AG has presented this four-factor test as an objective and conjunctive framework for discerning who is a county officer. By the way, this is an evolution from what they've argued all the way up until they filed their notice of appeal, which was a collapse of the county officer and officer question into the TUSA analysis. Now on appeal, they have presented this four-factor test for the very first time. And I rechecked the briefing. I know that's not in your record, but I rechecked the briefing in preparation for argument. It is not in their original opinion. It wasn't presented at summary judgment. It's not reflected in Judge Merritt's decision, which you certainly have before you. I think that that is a reason enough to disregard it, given that the court has said on countless occasions that you will not consider theories that are presented for the first time on appeal. And if my friend stands up in a moment on rebuttal and says that somehow this has collapsed into TUSA, I would urge the court to look carefully at how they presented it in their principal brief in this case. It is a different analysis. He presents TUSA as the officer question and this new four-factor test that no one's ever seen before, and this court has certainly never recognized, as a wholly separate and additional analysis after you've decided the officer question as to whether they're county officer. But even if the issue is fairly before the court, it fails by its own factors to capture several of the officers that I've been discussing. It requires, in factor three, and Mr. Campbell doubled down on it just a moment ago, that a county officer must reside in the county. With regard to county attorneys, when they're appointed, they can be anywhere. They can live anywhere. They don't have to live in their county of jurisdiction. County engineers and surveyors, again, if they fall into the category of county surveyors and engineers that are appointed, they don't have to live in their county. Veteran services officers, as far as we can tell, and I think we've comprehensively looked at all of the statutes that govern them, there is no county residency requirement. The stronger two there are certainly county attorneys and county surveyors and engineers. By the way, let me make one note. that notwithstanding their argument on the provisional appointment and election for county attorneys, that has nothing to do with this question for appointed county attorneys, which defeats their test. So to put a bow on that point, this four-factor test cannot apply in Nebraska, not least because you haven't recognized it, but because it wouldn't capture the county officers that we already know are county officers. So with the brief time I have remaining, it's a perfect segue to what is actually the most straightforward part of this analysis, which is without this new four-factor test, what does the court look to? And it's not that difficult. You look to statute. You look at the manifestation of what the legislature has determined it wants to do in terms of creating the characteristics of these particular offices, and whether they will trip the trigger of Article 9, Section 4 for purposes of requiring an election in service of the legislature's, and if I could finish my thought, Mr. Chief Justice.
You may.
In service of the legislature's overall goal that they wanted to create and maintain and expand for a century, an election commissioner system that would have independence, that would be separated from their own elections and would be dedicated to the large county election administration for reasons that matter and that remain highly relevant today, notwithstanding the absence of the Denison crime machine, they have through statute declined to categorize these officers as county officers in any of the places in chapter 23 or 32 where this court would look to find them. That, I believe, is dispositive on the question, on the threshold question in the case. So we would ask that the court affirm.
They identify as county employees in statute.
Yes.
Are they employees?
Sure, but I don't think that's dispositive. I think that's one particular element that pales in comparison, Justice Funk, to the overall statutory categorization that the legislature has declined to make.
The Attorney General makes the argument that just because the Secretary of State gives them some direction and some requirements they have to meet, that they still are independent county officers. What's your position with respect to that?
Yeah, so if a couple different answers. If we fall into sort of a scoreboard in terms of what from the Election Act portions govern election commissioner independence versus what oversight and supervision they have from the Secretary of State, we have deployed, and I could not, if I had wanted to, commit them all to memory, both as a factual and legal matter, an entire plethora of attributes that the election commissioners have that really place them in a way that is incomparable with any other county officer that either me or Mr. Campbell could think of, subject to state control. In response, they have cherry-picked a couple exceptions to that and also looked to a couple cherry-picked exceptions in other county officer positions where there might be some direction from a state official. At best, it's a draw. And as we've said, and as this court has consistently recognized, if there are two constructions of a statute, one of which that will yield a constitutional result, you should adopt the one that will yield the constitutional result. I think that applies here with full force. I think in the whole county, even if it did reduce to the TUSA analysis, which they rode all the way here and then amended their argument to add the four-factor test, you see offices that are entirely at the control, not entirely, but predominantly under the supervision and control of the Secretary of State in a way that no other county office is. So I don't think that carries the day.
If we did apply the four-factor test, what's your analysis in that respect?
Well, we've argued that they fail the fourth factor. And our response to that as being half-hearted, I don't think it is in the slightest. Unlike any other county office that we've discussed, the work that a major county election commissioner does is enormously important. I don't want to get too high altitude, but enormously important to everyone else in the state from the standpoint of democracy, just given the sheer characteristics, the population characteristics of those counties. But that's not all. they respond and say and characterize their work as being, as the other half of their work regarding non-statewide election administration, as being local in nature. And that's where his analysis stops, except that that local work also looks downward. It's not just county government specific. Look at what just happened a couple weeks ago here in Lincoln and in Omaha. We had the two major county election commissioners focused entirely on only on elections for only a portion of their county. That's not consistent with what we would otherwise think about as an attribute of the government nature of a county officer being wrapped up in county government work. So whether you look upward or downward, you really just have a relatively narrow slice in the middle where their work is focused on county elections. So I don't think that carries the day either. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much. Do we have time for rebuttal? 24 seconds, Mr. Campbell.
In 24 seconds, I can't do much, but I'll mention one or two points. In terms of the control that a state officer exercises, again, the argument was made that there's no comparable county officer that has similar oversight, but I just mentioned the county assessor and the county clerk. There's still no response to that point. And lastly, I would say that the factor analysis is legitimate. It's just one way to determine whether someone's a state officer or a county officer. But even if the court doesn't want to look to the factors, we win without them because we win under the analysis we made in the reply brief where we've undermined the argument they're making as to why these are state officers and not county officers. In fact, the opposite is true. We're dealing with county officers, and we ask the court to reverse the lower court's decision and order that the lower court enter summary judgment for the state. Thank you.
How do you respond to your opponent's argument that your analysis has shifted during the course of the case?
Your Honor, I don't think it has shifted in some senses. We've always focused on the TUSA factors. He is absolutely correct about that. Well, the TUSA factors help to determine whether someone's an officer. And so we made the argument below that this position is an office, and obviously the district court disagreed with us. On appeal, our opponents continued to press the argument that, well, yes, they might be an officer, but they're a state officer, not a county officer. And so what we did is we said, is there any Nebraska law on that? And we found none. So we looked more broadly because this is a question of first impression. And we did find other states that engaged in analysis and said, when you're trying to determine whether someone's a state or county officer, these are the things you look to. So we brought the court this persuasive case law from other jurisdictions. That's all we did in this case. Thank you.
Thank you very much. That concludes arguments in State X Rel Peterson versus Shively. Counsel, you are therefore excused, and that actually concludes arguments for the day. So the court is adjourned. Again, thank you.